reconvene. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good afternoon. We call case 02-2756W, State X Rel, the Cincinnati Insurance Company versus Circuit Court for Milwaukee County. And arguing for the Cincinnati Insurance Company is Lynn M. Miller. Miller or Mueller?
It is Miller.
Fine, counsel.
May it please the court, my name is Lynn Miller, and I represent the Cincinnati Insurance Company in this case before you today. The matter that's before this court arises out of an action that was filed by the Hidden Oaks Condo Association and 47 individual condominium owners. And the case itself arises out of claims that the Condo Association and the individual owners filed against the developers and the sellers of the condominiums for claims ranging from misrepresentation to construction defects or claims that they were not constructed in a workmanlike manner. And there's a multitude of claims, as the court can imagine, from 47 individual plaintiffs. The claims, however, while they're delineated in the complaint, there is no indication as to when exactly those damages or injuries occurred. The next step in the case that happened after the filing of the complaint is the defendants, the developers and the sellers, filed a third-party action against two insurance companies, my client, Cincinnati Insurance Company, and Continental. The reason for adding two insurance companies in this case arose out of the fact that the damages were not specified as to when they occurred in the complaint. So the defendants in this case added Continental and Cincinnati because they're not sure exactly when coverage would apply. And what the third-party complaint alleges is that Continental insured the defendants from 1996 to 1999, and that Cincinnati insured the defendants from 1999 to 2003.
I thought that there was a year in between them. I'm wrong, though.
There is a year, and that resulted from, at the time the complaint was filed, all that Cincinnati was able to find was the policy in 2000. However, the 2000 policy is a renewal, so presumably there is coverage from December 31st of 99 to 2000. Now, Cincinnati answered the third-party complaint and admitted that it issued the policies from December 31 of 00 to December 31 of 03. And in that answer, they pled their defenses under their policy, and one of those defenses in the primary one is that the damages, if any, that are proven have to occur during their policy period. Likewise, Continental answered the third-party complaint and said it issued policies from 1996 to 1999 and also said any damages that are pled and proven must occur during our policy period. There's absolutely no overlap between the policies here. Cincinnati comes after Continental, and there's no overlap between the two policies whatsoever.
So being united in interest means the point is that you never could have the same interest if the coverage is different? In other words, the coverage of these, I assume that there are multiple claims.
Correct.
Many, many. But the idea, as I gather, is that because the insurance companies have a unity in interest, that they may have the same interest. What are you saying, that the interests are different just because of different coverage times?
The policies themselves are also different. Continental issued inland marine policies and first-party property policies, whereas Cincinnati issued a general liability policy for a three-year period and an umbrella policy above that.
Yeah, so inland marine, what does that cover, like personal property in that?
That's correct.
I assume, okay.
Correct.
And the other didn't.
Right. And basically, I think this case would be different if we were talking about Cincinnati having issued, for example, a commercial general liability policy from 1996, say, to 1999, and then Continental issuing the umbrella, so we had the same period of time with two insurance companies. But that's not the case here. We have two separate companies with two separate policies and two completely separate periods. Now, after Cincinnati got added to the case, Cincinnati did ask for substitution, and the trial court denied it based on the fact that Continental had previously been awarded a substitution request. And the trial court's position was that as we've already discussed briefly here, the parties were united in interest in this matter, and under the statute, they're only entitled to one request for substitution between the two of them. Now, this Court has asked the parties to discuss the meaning of united in interest. And before I do that, I would like to note to the Court that the statute itself does say the parties have to be united in interest and pleading together. And I did want to note to the Court that in this case, we have Continental and Cincinnati represented by separate counsel. They both filed separate answers, which have both pled their specific defenses unique to their own policies and unique to their own policy periods. So I think it's important to note that in addition to the fact of the unity and interest issue.
Is it possible here that one company would be liable and not the other? And what I really mean by that is, let us suppose you covered the same year.
Correct.
Is it possible that one company would be liable and not the other because of the differences in the policy?
That's a possibility. Also, with the fact that there potentially could be underlying coverage and then umbrella coverage, that could also kick in. In this case, obviously, it's a completely different issue because if the damages occurred, obviously, I, as Cincinnati, am saying, no, Your Honor, don't find the determine the damages occurred in Continental's policy period, not in mine, and Continental is obviously saying the exact same thing.
And my next question is, if that one of the issues is what does united in interest mean, pleading together raises another issue, but what does united in interest mean? And one technique might be to say, could the same lawyer represent both companies in this case?
And I would have to say absolutely not, Your Honor, because the attorney would not be able to argue. He would have to argue both sides of the fence. The attorney, I would have to argue both that the damages occurred during one policy and during the other, and that's a complete conflict of interest. There's no way an attorney could do that.
You could argue that no matter when it occurred, neither one of these policies covers this issue.
Obviously, both parties are interested in the defense of the case. I mean, there's no question that both insurers would like the defendants to win and that there would be no damages awarded whatsoever. But because of the insurance policies and the third-party complaint, we have another unique layer, which is, do the insurance policies apply? And then if they do, who's going to be the one that's going to cover this? So it's not just whether the underlying defendants get hit. It's which policy applies.
And suppose that they were united interest about the policies. Both cover these years and both deny that liability occurs under exactly the same policy. Maybe one covers $1 amount and another dollar amount. And then they plead, they have two different counsel, and they plead separately. But if you look at the pleadings, they are the same except that the names are changed. So they don't plead together. Technically, they don't plead together, but they're the same. What would your argument be?
I think, frankly, if the pleadings were identical and the policies were identical, we would have a different case because the Court has already issued its decision in Karkel saying that the interests of the parties are the important issue, not the form of the pleadings. And so if the interests of the parties had been shown even by the form of the pleadings that they're identical, I think it would be a difficult argument to make that they were not united in interest. But in this case, we do have separate policies, separate policy periods, so there's simply no way that these two parties can be making the same arguments. Now, I touched briefly that basically the problem we have here is, unfortunately, the meaning of united in interest has never really been discussed other than by the Court in the Karkel case. And the Karkel case had facts that, if the Court recalls, involved a sole shareholder of a company by the name of Karkel, Inc. And that sole shareholder had a claim under a contract and was making a claim for breach of contract and some misrepresentation and other claims. And when he brought the claim, the sole shareholder brought it solely on his own behalf. And the contract, however, was in, the buyer was both the corporation, the sole shareholder, and the sole shareholder's spouse. So when the judge looked at the case, he decided that the company itself and the spouse should also be in because they all had a claim based on their position as buyers in this contract. And what happened in that case is once the sole shareholder was advised these other parties needed to be brought into the case, he brought them in, but he brought them as in as defendants rather than as additional plaintiffs or involuntary plaintiffs. And when the court looked at that case, it was clear that the sole shareholder and the corporation were looking at the same claim under the contract and were obviously united in interest and basically had identical interests.
Counsel, Mr. Rice, I think it was Mr. Rice, says Judge Skowronski found that your corporation effectively adopted all of Continental's affirmative defenses. Did you? Are all the affirmative defenses the same?
Actually, that is incorrect, Your Honor, in this respect. What Cincinnati did is adopted the defenses of the defendants in the case in the event it's found that Cincinnati covers. Obviously, if it's found that we cover the claims, we want to be able to make the same defenses that the defendants, the developers and the sellers make. We couldn't adopt the same affirmative defenses as Continental because Continental's affirmative defenses relate to their specific policy, and we don't have those provisions in our policy.
Okay. Goes on to say, also adopted common defenses, including failure to state a claim upon relief, upon which relief could be granted. Was that one of your defenses?
That was, Your Honor.
And is that a Cincinnati, is that a Continental defense or a defendant's defense?
That is actually a Continental defense as well.
Failure to mitigate damages.
I believe both of them pled that as well.
And the statute of limitations.
And that was pled by both as well.
Did you make any defenses that Continental did not?
The affirmative defenses that Cincinnati would have raised would have been the ones that we either put into our answer or we also adopted our complaint for declaratory judgment in that answer. And so what we would have that would be different is the affirmative defenses unique to our policy and our policy provisions that are detailed in that complaint and give us our rights and defenses under our specific policy.
All right. So how would you draft this opinion?
I think in this case, the big issue for me is, obviously in the insurance area, trigger is the big issue. Trigger, and whether the damages, you know, fall within your policy period is what Continental and Cincinnati are primarily concerned with. And I think that is the big issue in this case that has to be looked at. If there's simply no way that two separate insurers with two separate policy periods can be united in interest when they are both fighting for the damage, you know, determination to be at a different time. So I really think that's the big focus and how this decision should come down.
That's the conflict of in interest.
Conflict in interest, correct.
Ms. Miller, let me come at this a little differently. Wisconsin has repeatedly been characterized as one of the most liberal states in the nation as far as substitution of judge. There is a lot of argument that we're too liberal in regard to that approach and that it causes a lot of problems in the administration of the court system. Let's assume for a minute that that's correct. Why shouldn't we then take a very strict approach to interpreting the provisions of 801-58-3?
I would agree with the court that Wisconsin is liberal in this regard with the substitution statute. I can tell the court I took a look to see if there was any other state that had a similar statute, and there is no other state that gives this great right to defendants to be able to substitute once on a judge. The courts, however, have upheld it numerous times that this is a right that has been given by the legislature, and we intend to uphold it. And how the court can preserve that right and keep it from causing a problem is exactly with this issue of unity and interest that the court is looking at. If the parties are truly united in interest and are going to be arguing the same thing down the road, are going to be looking for the same decision by the judge on damages, then they should have one kick at the cat, so to speak, or one some substitution of judge. In this case, we are looking for completely different decisions from the court. I want the court to say all your damages occurred in 1997, and Continental wants it all to be after 2000. So I think this case is clearly one that there would not be a problem because the parties are just so separate in interest.
Well, that just seems to me so clear that how did they miss it? How did Judge Skowronski miss it? How did the Court of Appeals miss it? I mean, it seems to me, at least on the surface, that you're clearly adverse parties.
That's obviously Cincinnati's position, Your Honor, and the only thing I can think of is that when the court was looking at the parallel interest and decided that that was sufficient, which I do think under the statute is not sufficient. I mean, they wanted the parties
the
to be united.
The Court of Appeals missed it, too?
I must say to the Court, I think part of the problem with the Court of Appeals decision is, and I'll take this on myself as an error, I don't believe I had included all of the pleadings, and I don't know that the Court had in front of it the clarity of the fact that the policies were a completely different time periods. While I had argued it in my argument to the Court in my brief, it did not have the pleadings in front of it, and I think that may have made part of the problem in that case, that the Court didn't have that in front of it to see how clearly that different policy periods were intact.
In fact, I read both the Chief Judge and the Court of Appeals in a way that was very suggestive of affirming the trial court's decision. By that I mean the Chief Judge, bottom line, said, we give great deference, and that's what was the tool that the Chief Judge used, the deferential standard here. Not even though, as I saw, the Chief Judge went through this unity of interest, but the Chief Judge, bottom line, said, I'm going to give deference because there's a great deference here. And then the Court of Appeals, much like you said, didn't really opine on the issue, but instead took it from the negative. You didn't meet your burden.
Right.
You know, I don't mean to point at you. You know, I mean, that's the way. And so in some ways, I find neither the circuit court, neither the Chief Judge, nor the Court of Appeals really tackling the issue, but rather defaulting. I don't know if my read is correct. Maybe I'm asking the wrong person.
I must say, I did feel I was defaulted a bit in the Court of Appeals. And I thought that the trial court and the Chief Judge, when he reviewed it, somewhat missed the issue that we were talking about separate time periods. I would agree, frankly, that if we were talking about, as I said before, a policy that was then stacked with an umbrella, and as Justice Averson had said previously, that the policies were pretty much exact down row, that we'd be talking about a different case, and that maybe then they would be entitled to just one kick at the cat and one substitution. But in this case, that clearly was not the case.
Well, they specifically said in the Court of Appeals that, in support of your contention, Cincinnati notes that its policies and continental policies were not in effect at the same time. So you made that argument.
Right.
Then they go on and say, as Justice Bradley pointed out, Cincinnati has not carried its burden. And is that what you rest on here, that these policies are at different times, therefore you would be pointing fingers at each other, say, assuming there was damage, assuming it was covered by the policy, not us?
That is obviously the primary conflict. In addition, we also do have the issue of them being different policies. We have a commercial general liability and an umbrella, and as I said before, Continental has the inland marine and the first-party property coverage. So there are differences between the policies, but I think that the key issue for me is that there simply has to be a conflict here because of the different time periods and the fact that we are not going to be asking the judge to determine the same end result.
Could I ask you, Judge Amato found that the two insurance companies were united in interest. Is that a finding of fact, or is that a conclusion of law?
That, in this case, Your Honor, would have to be a conclusion of law based on his review of the statute 80158 and whether he thought it fit within the term united in interest, in the way I view it.
Could I ask you to address the question of pleading together? What does that mean?
Of course, that's another phrase that has not been defined, but in the Cincinnati's viewpoint, pleading together would obviously be if the two parties, one way you could look at it is the parties have the same lawyer and they're obviously doing the same pleading. Or as Justice Averson said before, if the parties were filing the exact same pleading and basically one is taking the other's pleading and putting their name to it, that kind of a thing, and they did not have separate policy provisions or separate defenses that they raised. In this case, that's clearly not the case because both policies are separate and both parties have pled their separate defenses based on their unique policy provisions. I did want to note to the Court, and I did mention it in my prior brief, that while the case doesn't specifically go into this issue, I did find the case that the Court decided in the Miller Brewing versus LARC decision somewhat interesting. While the Court was looking at a different statute, obviously, it was looking at the issue of what's an adverse party. And in that case, the Court considered two insurers and was looking at the fact that the two insurance companies had, similar to this, a joint issue in having the defendant's claims against the insured be dismissed or denied, but had separate issues as far as when the date of injury was. And the Court noted that specifically when it was looking at adverse interest. And I thought that was somewhat telling that the Court was viewing it that way for an adverse interest. How can we be united if we're adverse? Granted, it's another statute, but I think the way the Court was viewing it is this is obviously an adversity between the two parties. And I thought that was somewhat telling, too, and was interesting for this issue. I guess I'd just like to finalize, Your Honors, by saying that the right of substitution, as Justice Crooks indicated previously, is one that's important in Wisconsin, has been upheld by the courts consistently. And we just believe in this case that Cincinnati should be entitled to its right for substitution.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Rice, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal, counsel. Mr. Rice, Assistant Attorney General representing the Circuit Court for Milwaukee County.
May it please the Court, as the Chief has indicated, I'm David Rice. I'm from the Attorney General's office, and I have the honor of representing the Circuit Court from Milwaukee County in this case. What I'm starting off with is the direction of this Court in its order granting review that the parties shall address at oral argument. The meaning of the term united in interest is used in Wisconsin Statute 801-58. As I was thinking about this case last night, I was reminded of a period earlier in my life when I was in college in a history course, and I was to do a paper, American history, and we were supposed to choose a narrow topic capable of analysis and review in a single paper. And I chose as a topic the industrial development of the South between 1865 and 1880. Spent a lot of time in the State Historical Society. I enjoyed it. But what I determined after I had concluded my effort was that there wasn't industrialization in the South between 1865 and 1880, and I had very little to say, and I didn't get a very good grade on my paper.
So your point, counsel?
My point.
I hope you get a good grade here today.
I will start off with my ultimate point, and then I'll tell you how I get there. My point is that in Karkel, this Court defined united in interest using a dictionary definition as parties who are similarly interested in and will be similarly affected by the determination of the issues involved in the action. And after all of the work that I've done, I come right back to that definition, and I don't think you can improve upon it. So to answer your question, Justice Abramson, when you write your decision, I think you can start there and end there. I think that is an appropriate definition.
Might it not include the negative?
I'm sorry?
Might a definition of united in interest include a negative? You know, frequently when we're writing opinions, sometimes the best we can do is say, we know what it is not. And here, I just have this feeling, you know, that I'm really missing something, because it seems so clear to me that these parties, when you brush away everything, are adverse to each other, because Continental's going to say, not me, these all occurred during your watch. And Cincinnati's going to say, not me, these all occurred during your watch. And to me, that's ultimate adversity.
Well, my reaction when I was assigned this case and I reviewed Judge Amato's decision and then the Chief Judge in Milwaukee's decision was essentially the same as yours and Justice Bradley. And I don't know after having reviewed all the material in the file, that I would come out differently. But what I understood, what I think they were trying to say, and I think Justice Bradley's correct, we have the decision from Judge Amato. It's not a lengthy decision. It's a handwritten filling out of a form, just saying these parties are united in interest and there's been a prior substitution. Then you have Judge Skrowski, I think, trying to provide some meat for the decision. He says that he's going to be deferential. He says there's support in the record. That might go to your question, Justice Prosser, as to whether this is a fact question or a question of law. I think generally in this context, the application of the statute would be deemed a question of fact. It may have some, a question of law. It may have some fact repercussions as well. But I think perhaps the best way of putting, if we wanted to put a spin on what they've done to make it have an acceptable rationale, is there are ways in which the parties, the insurance companies, could unite with the developers and not even raise the question of which policy applied when. Cincinnati, Ms. Miller was correct, Cincinnati did not adopt the affirmative defenses of Continental. Continental actually pled later, so Justice Skrowski was wrong in that respect. But Cincinnati adopted were the affirmative defenses of the defendants, and I looked at that answer, the original defendants, and what they said was that, among other things, they didn't make the representations that were alleged in the complaint, and that even if they had made the representations, the breach of the contract by the homeowners and their association with respect to making certain payments resulted in an overall breach of the contract and limited their responsibility. So presumably there would be a way in which both insurance companies could make those assertions without ever getting to the issue of which policy applied when in terms of that potential conflict. And so in that sense, they would be united in interest, and they'd be united in interest with the defendants. The only problem that I have with that approach is that in Miller Brewing Company, when you were talking about whether two insurers were adverse for purposes of review, in that case, in the administrative proceeding, neither party raised the question that's raised here with respect to which a policy applied when. Both parties joined with the employer in that case in arguing that the employee simply didn't qualify for workers' compensation, not depending on time. And so everybody was in effect united or on the same page. But what you said in that case was that we don't look at how they participate in the case for purposes of determining whether they're adverse. We look at the potential for adversity. So if I were to apply that here, I probably would come out saying that they have the potential, at least, of not being united in interest. Then there's the practical problem, which I must confess I'm not an insurance company representative in litigation very often. I think I've never been. And what I'm told is that there's a great significance here in determining early on in the litigation which policy may be applicable, because there's a promise apparently in those policies to provide representation in the litigation. Apparently, Cincinnati has already undertaken responsibility initially for litigating the case until this can be resolved, but apparently they're seeking a determination early on as to whether one or the other is responsible. And so in that sense, even at this very earliest stage, they may not be united in interest.
Well, go back to CARCO, your analysis of CARCO, Mr. Rice. As I heard you, that may not be true, they clearly could be united on some issues, Continental and Cincinnati.
Correct.
And but my question to you, and I'd accept that, because there are some defenses that are going to get them both out, right?
Correct.
But then there are other defenses that will get one out but not the other, right?
That's right.
So the question then comes to me, if accepting that, is what does united in interest mean? Does it mean wholly, totally united in interest? Or does it mean, as some of the language of these cases in what Judge Skrowski would say, similarly interested? Similarly is not quite the same as totally And I'm not sure, and I have to read it more carefully, whether did you represent the Labor and Industry Review Committee in Milwaukee Brewing?
No, I've read the case. That was Lowell Noss in our office.
Okay. Whether there was reference either in the briefs or in the opinion to Karkel, so that because they're dealing with different statutes and different language, although I agree that there's an overlap. So does it mean totally? I happen to write both of those cases.
Yeah, I don't think there would have to be okay. Totally.
Substantially?
Because
significantly?
Well, I don't know if I could pick out the right adverb. In Miller Brewing Company, I think it was sufficient that there was a potential conflict, even though it hadn't evidenced itself in the administrative proceedings.
All right. Is there a potential conflict here between these two companies?
Yes.
In fact, we've had a case, and I'm sorry I can't pull it out of my head, maybe someone else on the bench can, where the argument between the two companies was time. That is, it happened on the other guy's watch. So there's a potential conflict. So is that good enough for United in Interest? I was thinking maybe the test has to be, could one lawyer represent both of them? And if there's a conflict between them, he or she cannot.
Right.
And I don't think the same lawyer could represent both here, but I'm willing to, you know, listen to argument that they could. You?
Probably only with consent, with waiver, so that they on the premise, I think, here, that they would raise the other arguments first.
What about the plain coverage itself in the policies? I mean, the arguments made, we're looking at general liability, we're looking at inland, which I know is a, the personal property, vis-a-vis an umbrella, which does not kick in until whatever the underlying amount is, whether it's X number, doesn't that distinguish, even saying that even if the coverage, talking about the policy time, was the same, the coverage itself would be, it is different.
I would think there'd be a potential for a conflict there as well.
Yes.
Counsel, when you did your paper, you limited your scope to 1865 to 1880, you said. And perhaps if you had expanded your scope, you'd have more to talk about. Mm-hmm. I'd like to expand the scope of this and to talk about pleading together and pleading together. In preparing for this case, I wondered, I wished that maybe we had expanded the question and not said what is just what United in Interest, because it says United in Interest and pleading together. I know the chief, at least it was my review, that the chief judge didn't make reference to that part of that phrase set forth in the statute, and understandably, you don't address it because we didn't ask you to, but I'm asking you if you're able to today. What can that mean? What does that mean? And pleading together.
Well, I know there's a rule of construction that says that you ought not construe words to be mere surplusage. But in this case, given my own thoughts about it and having listened to what the court said today, I'm hard-pressed to differentiate between them. If it literally means and pleading together, that means you'd be filing a single pleading on behalf of both companies. And I don't think that's what the statute meant, but it literally could be read that way. It could also be read to mean that your defenses or there's commonality between the defenses, but then that doesn't get you very far away from United in Interest. So I'm not sure that I'm being very helpful, but I don't know that I can be. What I can tell you is a little bit about the history of the statute, because I did have my law clerks do some research on that. One question I asked them was, well, this seems like it'd be a common problem. Why don't you look at other states or look at the federal civil procedure code and see if there's anything similar? And they really couldn't come up with anything. The best they could come up with, and this is the reason I didn't file a supplemental brief, because I really, that paper had very little to add. But there is a case called Goldman Sachs, which is 46 Pacific Second 606. And in that state, they use the word adverse. The United in Interest language isn't there. So parties that are non-adverse only get one substitution. Adverse parties get more than one. I had a law clerk look at the history of the ADO, the language in this case, the United Interest language. It was passed as part of 1969 Assembly Bill 520. The language that's now in the statute was enacted at that time. It was a recreation of an earlier statute. Law clerk looked at the drafting file, and there was nothing in the file that would give any indication of what the phrase "United in Interest" means. I looked at your opinion in Karkel, and I thought it was interesting because you surmised in that case that the phrase "United in Interest" must have come from the statute that dealt with joinder at the time.
260.12. Years to come. Mm-hmm.
And because that language did use "United in Interest," and you cited an annotation which said that had been a fertile source of litigation. So I went back and tried to look, see where that litigation said, and I was hoping I would encounter cases that said "United in Interest" means. But you know what? There aren't any cases that say that. And the cases that I did find, and one, of course, that I thought was interesting was one that bears my name, Will of Rice. But those cases have to do with the change of venue statute. And in those days, the change of venue statute also incorporated what I think we now think of as a substitution for bias or prejudice. And they had a provision for change of venue for bias. And what those cases said was that in order to have a change of venue under those circumstances, you had to have both parties or all parties on one side. So, instance, if one defendant asked for a change of venue based on a judge's bias, then all the parties would have to join in, and there were a couple exceptions. But that was the general rule. And they also said in those cases that you only need one affidavit from one of the parties and not from all of the parties. And if you look at the statute that we're looking at today, it incorporates that same language about only needing one affidavit. So I think that the origin of this "United in Interest" language comes not from the joinder statute. In all of those cases, and I looked at those, talk about the distinction between necessary parties and indispensable parties, but don't say how that relates to the magic words "United in Interest." I think it probably comes from those earlier change of venue cases, and there is a case called Dutcher versus Phoenix Insurance at 37 Wisconsin 2nd 591, in which the court said this applies not only in terms of change of venue generally, but also in cases of bias on the part of the judge, and cited Will of Rice, which in turn cited cases going back to the late 1800s. So as in that research paper I did, I enjoyed doing some of the research and looking at some of the history, but I've come up blank in terms of it being helpful to us.
No, it's better than industrialization of the South. You're never going to live that down, Mr. Rice. Well, what's your conclusion?
Well, my conclusion is that that you really don't have to do anything more with the definition. I think you can use the definition that you adopted in Karkel. I think it's a helpful definition. Unfortunately for the party that I represent, I'm not sure that applying it that you would come out in favor of affirming the circuit court.
If that's what I was going to ask you, your bottom line is you got a little problem in this case.
I do.
How big is this little problem? It's the problem that Justice Babbage identified. It's clear on its face. I mean, the problem is time, let alone the other problems you have about what the policy means. And going back to Karkel said there's no single definition of the phrase "United in Interest." Looked at Black's Law Dictionary, and then it finally wound up doing what Justice Babbage suggested here, saying, who cares? Whatever the scope means, they didn't need it here. And here in Karkel, whether the court was right or wrong, and I'm the author of it, it said they're identical. So we don't have to fuss about potential, significant, substantial, similar. They're identical, and that has to be united and interested, regardless of whether they're called plaintiffs or defendants, et cetera.
Right. And the one case in which it's been applied since then by the Court of Appeals, which is Village of Tigerton versus Minichesky, they didn't have any problem with saying that all the individual parties in that case were united for obvious reasons. And, and there is an issue of burden of proof. In Karkle, you said the burden's on the person seeking substitution. But that only goes so far.
And that's true
right.
here, too.
Right.
Okay.
Mr. Rice, there is a statute, 81403, costs to defendants. Are you familiar with that?
Generally, Your Honor.
Subsection 2 of 81403 says, where there are several defendants who are not united in interest and who make separate defenses by separate answers, if the plaintiff recovers against some but not all of such defendants, the court may award costs to any defendant who has judgment in the defendant's favor. Now here, in order to qualify for costs, they have not only united in interest, but who make separate defenses by separate answers. Are these the flip? Is this the flip side of 80158 sub 3?
It might be, at least with respect to the concern about pleading together. It seems to me that helps to answer what pleading together means. It would be the converse, where they raise separate defenses. I don't know if I answered your question.
I want to make sure I understand. I think you were very eloquent in saying, acknowledging that you had a problem. Are you conceding this case or not?
Your Honor, I was. I addressed that issue with the former chief of the Milwaukee County Circuit Court, and he asked that I make the whatever arguments I could in support of his decision.
And, and you have to.
I have endeavored to do that. But if nothing else, I think in all my appearances before this court in the past, I endeavor to be candid, and I'm attempting to be again today.
Appreciate that. What about this is a let me throw this at you and get your reaction to it. I don't know the precise, that's what I got in my notes, I don't know the precise parameters of what united in interest are, but I do know what it is not. Parties are not united in interest when they are adverse to each other in any significant manner. Is that a fair enough? Is that a fair definition? In other words, using the negative to define.
Yeah,
the
I think that would be consistent with that Montana case and with the language in Miller Brewing. Of course, Miller Brewing, you're construing a statute which uses the word adverse, but there's no reason why you can't use adverse in trying to formulate a clearer definition of united in interest.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Rice, my major concern here is not with a case in Milwaukee County, because there are 47 circuit judges there, mm-hmm. but suppose we were in Vilas County. Is there any way, maybe there isn't, but is there any way to kind of tighten the application of these rules in a single-judge county?
I'm not aware of any distinction that can be drawn between counties as to the number of circuit judges that sit in those counties. This may be a case where, as Justice Crooks alluded to, there may be policy concerns, but I think those are better addressed to the legislature. It may be that it's too broad. I know in handling cases on behalf of judges and dealing with substitution issues, just the mere assignment of a case from one judge to another as a result of a substitution requires a significant amount of administrative detail and inconvenience. And if it happens multiple times, then that's replicated each time.
Don't the statistics show that substitution is used far more frequently in criminal cases, though, than in civil?
I don't know. I defer to your information. I don't know the answer to that.
They do.
I assume you're right. I have no idea.
Anyway, the issue here isn't whether we are overruling the substitution clause. The issue is how do we interpret this statute.
Right. Exactly. That's all I have.
Thank you, Mr. Rice. And as always, we do appreciate your candor in presenting the analytical framework and then how it applies.
Do you have anything more to say?
Well, do you want to say anything? Restrain yourself. I suggest you restrain yourself.
Don't hold.
I was just going to say, I wish I could come up with something.
You can't do better than Mr. Rice.
I was going to say, I wish I could come up with something particularly eloquent to end this with, but to be honest, I was trying to come up with something, and unfortunately I could not come up with anything further, so I guess the best I could do is ask if the court had any other questions of me.
What did you do your research paper on?
I have to admit, I do not remember, so and it was probably that bad this
morning. Mr. Justice Prosser has a question for you.
Suppose the facts were exactly the same as in this case, except the counsel for Continental got on the telephone with the counsel for Cincinnati and said, let's say we got Judge Cooper here. Should one of us move for substitution? And then after they get Judge Amato, they call up and say, should we get rid of Judge Amato? Does that change the rules any?
Well, I would hate to think that occurs. I don't think it changes the rules because the rule itself still requires that parties that are not united in interest get one substitution.
Well, so aren't they in united in interest now under Justice Prosser's fact situation? I think that's what he's raising with you. They have become united in interest, at least as to one aspect of the case.
But their unity of interest would only be in their desire to remove that one judge. It wouldn't be to
or delay the case.
Potentially. And I think what the court's really trying to look at in these statutes is, are the parties going to want the same determination from the judge? Are they looking for the same end outcome in the case? And they simply are not.
Well, you understand. I personally think you have a good argument on the merits here. But I'm extremely concerned about how people can abuse this right. And I'd like to have some guidance from you on how to write an opinion that doesn't encourage litigants to abuse this right.
I do think just in the nature of the timing of the statute, there is some protection because parties only have a 60-day window from when they're brought in a case to do this. And I think that gives sufficient protection because you're not going to have a situation normally where parties are going to be brought in over time. I mean, that would take I guess potentially that could happen if parties really planned accordingly, but I think that would take a great deal of planning that I would hope attorneys would not be doing. But normally that window is going to shut, so there's only going to be a certain time period that this is going to be able to happen. And I don't think your concern that there would be multiple judge shopping would actually happen.
Any other questions? Thank you, Ms. Miller. Thank you, Mr. Rice. And that concludes our hearing in 02-2756-W, State X Rel Cincinnati Insurance Company versus Circuit Court for Milwaukee County. We are in recess until 9:45 tomorrow morning.
Well, I wish I had the plaintiff's attorneys that knew that. I wish I had the plaintiff's attorneys that knew that.